Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. The owners of a West Virginia mine are calling it a miscommunication that loved ones of the 13 miners trapped underground were first told the men were alive, only to find out later that 12 of them, in fact, had died. Late last night, church bells started ringing throughout Tallmansville, West Virginia. Even Governor Joe Manchin reportedly left the church after hearing the good news, promising to return with the miners. The announcement went out around the world, and some of this morning's newspapers' headlines declared they're alive. 3 hours later, the mine owners told the families that the initial information was incorrect. 12 of the miners were dead, but one man, 27-year-old Randall McCloy, survived, and he remains hospitalized in critical condition. Ann Tyson is a national reporter with The Washington Post who is at the Sago mine. Ann, thanks for being with us once again.
My pleasure.
How did the families initially hear that their loved ones were alive? Did the company tell them that directly?
According to the company officials, a word came from within the mine from rescuers into a command post that many people heard. And the clear understanding of everyone, including the president of the mine, was that the men were alive. The president later told reporters that, following a press briefing, that he believed that the command post had then notified the families at the church.
So someone within the mine initially gave the information, and according to everyone involved, it was very clear that these men were, in fact, alive.
Yes.
Okay. You were outside the church shortly thereafter. How were people reacting at that point?
They were ecstatic. They were extremely emotional. They were saying, you know, yes, I mean, we had lost hope, but they're alive, they're all alive, and they're going to be coming across that, you know, the bridge, which was adjacent to the church in 15 minutes. I mean, there was just an incredible anticipation, incredible joy.
And the governor, in fact, announced that he was going to be helping bring them over to the families, yes?
Yes, he did. He, according to the pastor of the church, who was also, fully believed that they were all alive and you know, they were celebrating there for a number of hours, said the mayor told him that, he'll be back. He left and said he'll be back with the men.
Mm-hmm. A few hours later, the second announcement was made. What happened then?
Upshur County Police Sheriff and several carloads full of police, presumably also with mine officials, went into the church. I saw them rush past. No media was allowed to follow them in. It appeared that they were very somber. It appeared that perhaps they were just going to notify that one family who had lost someone who the body had been found earlier, that they're of that loss. That's what it appeared to be happening. A number of ambulances pulled up outside. I mean, people speculated that perhaps the miners were even in those ambulances. And within a few minutes after that, the news just spread like wildfire, and very angry miner families came out of the church, some of them sobbing, very emotional, others just incredibly angry, saying that they had been lied to, and that, you know, the mine should be shut down. And apparently, I'm told by a number of sources in the church that there was physical threats of violence against the mining officials.
And what do the mining officials say? What do they attribute this to? Just miscommunication from that initial information that came from within the mine?
I'm not sure exactly how they put it to the families, but in a follow-up press conference afterwards, yes, they attributed it to a misunderstanding. Although they admit that, you know, they fully believe that all the men were alive and were themselves in a celebratory mood. But the critical point, as I understand it, is that after they received some further information after that from the underground that, you know, not, you know, that perhaps only some of them were alive, or it became unclear how many of them were alive. And it was clear to the mining officials that they did not know exactly who had lived or not. But that uncertainty was never conveyed to the families or anyone else.
All right. Anne, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Anne Tyson is a national reporter for The Washington Post. She joined us from Sago, West Virginia, where 12 of 13 miners trapped underground since Monday morning were found dead earlier today. The debate over whether there's a liberal bias on college campuses appears to be intensifying. Right now, legislation is pending in about a dozen states that's designed to counter what is seen as a left-leaning bias in the classroom. In Pennsylvania, a legislative inquiry is underway to determine if professors at that state's 18 public colleges and universities are too liberal and what should be done about it. Critics say political pressure, though, would have a chilling effect on scholarship. We will hear from both sides in this debate. First, we're joined by Pennsylvania Republican State Representative Gibson Armstrong, who began this inquiry. Mr. Armstrong, why did you start investigating whether there is this liberal bias on campus?
Whether the bias is liberal or conservative, to me, is not what's germane, Deb. What is important to me is that our state universities educate rather than indoctrinate. And I don't care what type of indoctrination is taking place, if in fact there is. It's inappropriate on a campus that is being funded through tax dollars.
So explain to me what you think is happening right now in Pennsylvania and why you think that's indoctrination.
We know that nationwide there is a problem with a lack of free speech. The question that we asked in Pennsylvania is, do we have a problem here? I think it is incumbent upon the legislature on behalf of the taxpayers that provide almost $2 billion to fund our state higher education, to ask the question whether there is a lack of diversity of thought on our state campuses.
At this point, do you think there is a problem in Pennsylvania?
Well, I think that we do have a problem. We've had two hearings so far, and the reason we held hearings rather than introduce legislation was because we wanted to determine if we do have a problem. I heard from numerous students from around the state, about 50 of them, claiming that they had either been treated differently because of their political or religious or view of life bias, or they have professors who are spending a considerable amount of class time on subjects that are not germane to the course. The point is, on our college campuses, there ought to be free speech and debate of ideas. And if you're a communist and you can articulate that point of view, you ought not to be singled out for that.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about singling out a viewpoint, I'm just curious as to what viewpoint is being singled out here.
Well, in this particular viewpoint, this particular professor asserts, or according to the student, asserts that it is impossible to be a moral capitalist. The U.S. does not have the right to say anything about the Taliban's record of oppressing women because the U.S. oppresses women, too.
The things that you're talking about are very anti-Washington, anti-Bush administration.
Sure.
So it does sound like what you're saying is, even though at the start of this conversation you said it was indoctrination regardless of the way in which the indoctrination was going, but it sounds as if there's a definite slant here that you're opposed to.
Well, there may be, Deb, but, you know, if this person was, if Clinton were in the White House and this individual were articulating such a viewpoint against the Clinton administration from the lectern and bringing in material, you know, subject matter that was not germane to the class, if that was indoctrination, that's just as wrong.
Some might argue, though, that trying to clamp down on how professors handle differing viewpoints in a classroom really would hamper the whole education process and the higher education process overall. So just tell me, how do you go about investigating this bias?
Well, if that's the case, Deb, then why do these universities have policies in place that say that professors are to stick to their subject of expertise? They're not to introduce material that is not germane, nor are they to advocate their own personally held views.
When you say that there are various standards, how do you determine, okay, we have a bias here, we have a problem here, or it's just part of the lecture?
What we want is for the universities to simply enforce their own policies. And that's a question left for that's best answered by the provosts of the various state institutions. If a student from Pittsburgh who's going to the University of Pittsburgh says, oh, my professor gave me a C when I deserved an A, that is very subjective, and I'm not interested in being a referee in something like that. I think as a legislature, our focus ought to be on policy. Do these universities enforce their own policies? Do they have policies in place that are illegal or unconstitutional? And what we found at our first hearing and our second hearing is that, yes, there's evidence that that exists. For example, one state university in their social work program had in the hiring ad that applicants must be advocates for social justice. Social justice, distributive justice, economic justice are terms that we saw throughout a couple different universities. Those terms are very politically laden. They're not open to interpretation. In academia, what those terms mean are redistribution of wealth.
So you think that what they're really saying is that they're advocating socialism?
That's correct. If you ask anyone in academia, what is social justice? What is distributive justice? They'll tell you those terms have specific meanings. It's not just...
But they won't say that they necessarily are socialism.
Well...
That's an interpretation.
It's a widely held interpretation in academia.
It was my understanding that there might be a review of voter registration of some professors.
Oh, sure, there was. In fact, Steve Balch, who testified at our Pitt hearing, did an analysis of university professors around the state, and I think it was not voter registration, it was by contributions, and found that an overwhelming majority of professors who had contributed or were politically active financially, were politically active toward Democrat candidates.
So what's the problem with that, then?
It's an indication that falls in line with what other national studies have shown, and that is the professoriate on almost every college campus is very left-leaning.
Now, this has been going on nationally for quite some time, and folks have said that the evidence suggesting that there's discrimination of thought is flimsy, and it really isn't a place for government intervention, that schools should be able to regulate themselves. What would you say to those folks?
Well, the administration and the professoriate on our various universities should be self-policing. However, the evidence is not flimsy. The evidence is significant that they're not.
Gibson Armstrong is a state lawmaker from Pennsylvania. Just ahead, the other point of view. A history professor says government oversight of what is said in a classroom will weaken what is taught. There's more coming up here and now. It's here and now. We're continuing our conversation about legislative hearings in Pennsylvania, investigating complaints of a liberal bias at that state's public universities. Earlier, we heard from Republican lawmaker Gibson Armstrong. Joining us now is UCLA history professor Russell Jacoby, who opposes legislative efforts to control content in the classroom. Professor Jacoby, what do you make of this investigation in Pennsylvania?
Well, I must say, I think it is a bit of a red herring that that we have here an effort of censorship in the name of academic freedom. I mean, certainly given the size of the higher education, there are some abuses around, but we have the irony of conservatives now coming up with a kind of diversity criteria criterion. They want conservative viewpoints adequately represented, and they offer, as far as I can see, very little evidence that there's a problem, but they are very eager to enforce this new measuring rod of conservative diversity.
As Representative Armstrong suggests, there are more Democrats than Republicans, and so therefore they think that there is a certain viewpoint espoused by these Democrats on college campuses. And they say if there were, was a similar lack of diversity in other fields, people would be complaining. What do you say to that argument?
Well, there's many things to say, but first of all, the question of Democratic overrepresentation doesn't mean anything in terms of how people teach courses and how, what people say in classes. It's manifestly absurd that they demonstrate looking at voter registration or financial contributions to candidates and therefore assume that in, you know, the art history courses, the Democrats are going to teach it different than a Republican. I mean, there's a leap there, which I think is absurd. And the only upshot is that, yes, we want to have parity of, you know, financial contributions in the faculty, which is equally absurd. I mean, I don't see where this kind of evidence really leads.
Well, they did say that they were receiving complaints from students who said that they were discriminated against in classes because of their political viewpoints.
Yes, I'm aware of that. And if you look at the complaints, and there's a number of groups that monitor and assemble these complaints. And Representative Armstrong himself, I mean, he waffled like, oh, you know, someone complained that, you know, they heard some tirade about a rock and maybe they got a C in the class, but he doesn't want to get involved in that. But many of them are of that caliber, that is, disgruntled students. And to be sure, I one can believe that given the number of courses and the number of teachers, some teachers are probably abuse their classroom space. But does it really, is there a pattern somewhere that requires intervention of the government? It's a pretty sobering conclusion here that education shouldn't be controversial, that we, you know, every viewpoint has to be presented even handedly. Where that leads, I think, is, you know, completely suspect, because at that point, it's not education. It's a cafeteria where everyone is, you know, every position that gets equal time. The suggestion which he keeps backing away from, and even the other groups back away from, but it's the logical thing they're asking, is that we want classes to be monitored to make sure that the reading, the assignments, and the comments are even-handed. And it seems to me, as a program, this would be a disaster, because it would mean, you know, it's Big Brother looking at the classrooms and trying to figure out if something has been off balance in terms of comments. And I might say again that most of the complaints, I think, you know, which triggered some of these investigations, are extremely minor. I mean,
let's talk about just one of those specific examples that Representative Armstrong brought up about an ad at a state university that a state university put out for a social work for someone to work in their social work program, asking
right.
that someone be an advocate for social justice.
Yeah, give me a break. I mean, yes, he said that's, you know, that's a word for socialism. I mean, that's pretty debatable. But in any case, it seems to me, and this is what some of the testimonies before this their committees have looked at, they look at policy statements or some of these websites where departments say what they're interested in. And yes, big surprise, women's studies are interested in equality, and maybe some of the social welfare groups are interested in social justice. I mean, yes, one could get upset about some of these descriptions of the program, that they don't seem to be balanced. But it doesn't seem to me that adds up to much. It's certainly easy to look at some of these policy statements, but it's much more difficult, and this is the real issue, is what happens in the classroom. And at that point, I think there's a real danger if you're going to monitor and try to get diversity. I mean, you know, there are Holocaust deniers, there's flat earth believers, there's conspiracy theorists. I mean, what does diversity mean intellectually? How does one begin to apportion that out?
So can you? Can you or can anyone, a state lawmaker or a university or any association, can you say that what we're doing here is presenting a balanced view to our students, and how do you define that?
Well, I think on the state level, it will be a disaster that we demand diversity in history classes and sociology classes. What about in biology classes, yes? I mean, do we want intelligent design? I mean, there's certainly people who believe if you're not going to say that the teacher can decide that, which in essence, this is what they're pushing for, that is, we want teachers to answer to the state and to a general diversity program, then you're pushing a series of viewpoints which you know, I think would gut education. I mean, I certainly, you know, I think there is a disproportionate number of liberals, and you know, but the idea that there was more Kerry supporters than Bush supporters, and that this demonstrates a problem. And this is one of the big, you know, this is the evidence, is absurd.
Professor Jacoby, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Deb.
Russell Jacoby is a history professor at UCLA. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes
for In for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Many lawmakers in Washington, D.C. are now scrambling to give away campaign contributions tied to tainted lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Even the White House is promising to give donations linked to Abramoff to charity. The once high-flying Abramoff appeared sheepish in federal court yesterday when he apologized for his mistakes and pleaded guilty to fraud and conspiracy charges, admitting that he bilked clients out of millions of dollars and tried to bribe lawmakers with luxurious trips and cash. And this scandal has the potential to shift the political landscape in Washington. Joining us to talk about this are Julian Zelizer. He's a congressional historian and a professor at Boston University. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Also on the line from Washington is Peter Stone of the National Journal. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Good to be with you.
Peter, let's start with you. Which lawmakers have been implicated here?
Well, so far, based on yesterday's plea agreement and the earlier one late last year that Michael Scanlon agreed to. He was Abramoff's former partner in this kickback scheme that's been portrayed by the Justice Department. The one lawmaker referred to as representative number one is clearly Congressman Bob Ney of Ohio, who is not mentioned by name, but the descriptions, the detailed descriptions of things that he did, actions that he took, or legislative favors that he agreed to clearly match up with what's been reported that Congressman Ney did in exchange for a variety of gifts, including a lavish trip to Scotland that he took in 2002, a golf junket with Abramoff, free meals at Abramoff's restaurant, and other campaign contributions that he received from Abramoff's partner, Michael Scanlon. Essentially, Ney was an ally of Abramoff's on two or three different issues, the most prominent of which was probably the his effort in 2002, right before the golf trip to Scotland, that has been portrayed in Senate hearings last year as an effort to introduce a bill to reopen a casino that was closed in early 2002 in Texas of one tribe that Abramoff represented. This was a casino that belonged to the Tigwa tribe. Abramoff and Scanlon were hired for $4 million to help get it reopened. In the way that their scheme worked, typically Jack recommended Scanlon be hired. Scanlon got the fees and had a secret kickback arrangement to give almost half of those fees to Abramoff.
And when we talk about those fees, roughly and briefly, how much money are we talking about?
Well, altogether, Abramoff and Scanlon took in a stunning $82 million in fees over a three-year period from six different tribes. Mm-hmm. That's according to the Senate investigators who've looked at this for over a year. The Justice Department plea agreements have focused on four tribes, and in their separate plea agreements with Scanlon and Abramoff, they cited Scanlon late last year that he owed the tribes $19.7 million in fees. The Abramoff plea agreement referred to $25 million in restitution.
Okay, let's get back to, hold on,
sure.
Let's just get back to some of the
sure.
lawmakers here. We talked okay, about, Peter,
yes,
bear
with
me.
He's the one who's been cited thus far. There were two Hill aides, again, anonymously referred to in the plea agreement as staffers A and B.
Right, okay, okay.
Aides,
Peter, bear with me now. We also have heard mentioned Senator Burns from Montana, Congressman Doolittle from California, and also former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. There are also reports that spouses of some of these lawmakers were paid by Abramoff or hired by companies that had ties to Abramoff. And Julian, I'd like to ask you, in terms of legality here in the spouse issue, what was happening there?
Well, it's a fuzzy area in that now in an era of two spouse families, there are many men and women who work half in Congress and half in interest groups. And there are allegations that wives were hired by strategy groups as basically payback to staffers or even to members of Congress for currying their favor.
So is the law unclear, or is there, what does it say?
It is. There are disclosure rules about revealing this kind of interaction. There's broad guidelines. But in the modern world, again, of two income families, it's very hard for Congress to impose strict guidelines on this.
Mm-hmm. So does that make...
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
I
sure.
jump in on this for a minute? Some of the specifics in the plea agreement aren't fuzzy or vague. They're very specific. And in the plea agreement yesterday, for example, the staffer who is referred to as A, former deputy chief of staff to Tom DeLay, Tony Rudy, it specifically cites legislative help that Rudy was providing to Abramoff on a internet gambling measure that was opposed by Abramoff in 2000. At the same time, according to the plea agreement, that his wife was paid $50,000 through a nonprofit in exchange for her husband's, quote, agreement to perform a series of official acts, according to the plea agreement. This is certainly illegal, if true, as alleged in the plea agreement, and doesn't seem related to, you know, two spouse income relationships in any way.
Well, I think that's the issue in terms of both the spousal issues as well as the campaign contributions, et cetera, whether there was clearly an exchange of the hiring or the money for a benefit in terms of Congress reacting on a piece of legislation. That's at the heart of this case.
Right. Will it be different in this case in terms of trying to prove bribery here? What do you think, Julia?
Absolutely. I mean, that is the difficulty of the case. I mean, a lot of the practices we're looking at the broadest level are common practices of the world of Washington. But here we might have a case where someone pushed the boundaries farther than they can go, and there was evidence of a clear exchange between the lobbyist and the legislator, and that's what we're looking for.
Mm-hmm. But because of that, then, the legal definition of bribery, does it have to change somewhat because the limit was pushed, and then where exactly is that line?
Well, there are rules in Congress, for example. Passed in 1977 and revised in the 1980s with limits and guidelines on what can happen. So there are rules in place. Anything doesn't go in Washington, despite some people how they think about the place. And I think that's what's going to be looked at right now.
Peter, at this point, how close does it appear that Abramoff was to the White House?
Well, Abramoff was a top fundraiser for the Bush campaign in 2004. He was one of the elite pioneers. He'd been a big fundraiser previously. Two of his longtime allies in Washington are very close to the White House, Grover Norquist and Ralph Reed, both of whom were instrumental in his rise as a lobbyist in Washington. What's being looked at in the investigation, one Bush administration official already has been indicted, a former top official at OMB, for lying about information to investigators with regard to the trip to Scotland that was arranged by Abramoff for Ney. David Safafian, the OMB official, went on this trip. At the time of the trip, Abramoff was lobbying him for help. He was at that time at another agency, at General Services Administration, and Abramoff was lobbying him for help. He denied that he was being in contact with Abramoff at the time. He has been indicted and has pleaded not guilty. another administration official, former number two at the Interior Department.
Peter, bear with us 1 second. We're going to take just a short break, and we'll go right back to you. You're listening to Here and Now. Stay with us. All right, Peter, you were talking about a second official. Can you...
a former number two to Gail Norton at the Interior Department, Stephen Griles, is also under scrutiny by the Interior Department officials and the Justice Department, apparently, for help that he allegedly provided to Abramoff clients, Indian tribes that Abramoff was representing when he was at the Interior Department. Griles has denied providing any help, but in congressional testimony and through emails that were provided to the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, it appears that Griles may have provided certain help that he certainly is now being scrutinized for. He was also offered a job by Abramoff and his partners, while he was in a position at Interior to affect legislative matters that their clients were concerned with. Those are the two who have been mentioned as under scrutiny thus far. I think the Congress is where the most intense scrutiny is underway, and besides the one, Mr. Ney, as you mentioned, there have been press reports that Conrad Burns, who accepted something like $150,000 in contributions, which he has returned now or pledged to return from Abramoff and his clients, Senator Burns has been under scrutiny, denied doing anything improper. Congressman John Doolittle, whose wife has run the consulting firm in Washington that was hired by Abramoff's law firm to do some consulting work, is said to be under scrutiny. And probably most significantly, former House Majority Tom DeLay, who was Abramoff's key ally on several client issues beyond helping kill attacks for Indian that one of his Indian tribes opposed in the mid-90s. DeLay was also a key ally on a foreign client of Mr. Abramoff's, the Northern Mariana Islands. He took one trip to the Marianas that Abramoff helped arrange. He also was on two lavish foreign trips to Moscow and Scotland.
So it sounds as if, really, that this story has amazing legs, and this reaches into various areas. Julian, I'm wondering if I can ask you, what sort of consequences might Abramoff face because of this? I know that some have already been outlined. Can you?
Well, Abraham's consequences are jail time and, you know, his reputation and his future. I think the bigger question is the Republican Party and whether this has consequences or not. Will this be like the House Bank scandal in 1991, which helps lead to the Republican Revolution of 1994? Or will it be a scandal that primarily affects the lobbyists and a few legislators rather than the broader political context? And that's what's going to unfold in the next few weeks,
and
months.
Have we seen how Democrats might also use this scandal?
Yeah, well, they're clearly already talking about a culture of corruption in Washington, D.C., and they're pointing out that Abramoff goes back to the Republican Revolution of 1994. He's been a central figure in the K Street Project and in people like Tom DeLay and Newt Gingrich's lives. So whether they can make that case that this is a Republican scandal and not a congressional scandal is what we have to see.
And Peter, what about lobbyists? How are they reacting to this case?
Well, lobbyists are obviously very nervous. Many of them fear that the normal business practices that they pursue, campaign contributions, meetings with legislators, are going to be tarred by the scandal. I think while those fears are sort of widespread in Washington, I think more significantly we're going to see some reform legislation, or a good potential for reform legislation next year, to require more disclosure of lobbying activities. Senator McCain and Feingold have introduced slightly different measures already that would require more public disclosure and other means to follow lobbying more closely and to make it more transparent. One of the key issues is the heart of this scheme that Abramoff pulled off with his former partner Michael Scanlon, where they received almost $82 million in fees. The heart of the scheme was a secret kickback arrangement they had, where Scanlon was hired for work that did not have to be disclosed publicly. He was a grassroots specialist.
Thanks very much. We're out of time. Peter Stone of the National Journal, Julian Zelizer of Boston University, and a congressional historian. Thanks to both of you for being with us. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Becker, it's here and now. What's a culinary anthropologist? Well, you could consider Jeffrey Alford one. Alford and his wife, Naomi Duguid, are veteran travelers who also love food. Together, they've written four books that are sold as cookbooks, but are so much more. They've written about flatbreads, rice, and the cuisine of Southeast Asia. Their latest endeavor is titled Mangoes and Curry Leaves, Culinary Travels Through the Great Subcontinent. It's a massive book that spans many cultures, and Robin Young recently spoke with Jeffrey Alford about the book and about his introduction to South Asia.
I went first time in 1977, so I got myself across Turkey and Iran and Afghanistan and got into Pakistan and India, and then I stayed about a year and a half, and then I came home. And then immediately coming home, I thought, oh, no, this is more interesting being traveling, so I went pretty much straight back.
I guess I just wondered, first off, I read about you traveling through these countries, eating with families and in restaurants. You know, I've traveled quite a bit, but when do you know that you can start eating the food of the place you're traveling in without getting sick? I mean, it's just, you know, it's a fear a lot of people have.
Oh, boy, I used to get sick a lot. So I don't get sick much anymore.
It's just time?
I don't know if that's because I think to some extent, you know, your intestinal flora develops, but also things change. And groundwater in the subcontinent is way better than it used to be. And I think it's a combination of getting smarter and also things getting better.
Yeah. Well, the new book, Mangoes and Curry Leaves, we all know mangoes. What's a curry leaf? And is it, you know, as in curry powder?
No. I don't even know where they got this English name, but it's a bush, a little bit like a bay leaf bush. It's not a strong taste in food, but it is an incredible smell. So if you imagine sort of your saute pan and you have some oil in there, as if we're olive oil or something, and you throw a handful of leaves in there, it smells just incredibly good, just sort of like bread baking in the oven. You know, I think everybody likes the smell. And so then suddenly there's just good smell, there's cooking, you know.
Well, the book features foods from Bangladesh, India, Nepal, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka. Let's start with the biggest country in the group, India. A cuisine that varies tremendously. Can you just tick through some of the different varieties?
When we first started the book, we thought we're not from the subcontinent, first of all. So
no, you're from Wyoming,
I hear. We're from Wyoming, right? You know, so the book is primarily about being in the subcontinent as a foreigner. And we thought what it gave us the freedom to do is to go everywhere. Like for us, we're very interested in, I guess, what you call issues around cultural survival, or we're really interested in a lot of indigenous peoples living in the subcontinent. There's a very large, what you might call, gypsy population. Our job is to be on the periphery. Like, there's a lot of cookbooks that cover really Delhi or cover the Punjab, but I mean, we wanted to give a sense of the entire scope, which is just, you know, I don't know if you've ever opened one of those pink bags of insulation, you know, and you stick the knife in there and suddenly the insulation just starts coming out and growing and growing and growing. Mm-hmm. That's really what food in the subcontinent is like, because once you start inquiring, it just gets giant.
Well, in fact, even the way it's eaten is not just is powerful. In fact, there's a passage on page 85. Set this up first. Explain to us. People almost always eat with one hand.
Absolutely, you eat with one hand because it's a culture without toilet paper, right? So one hand wipes and one hand eats. So it's a very important thing that you only eat with your right hand.
And very hard, you write, for foreigners to do it first.
There are styles. And it's sometimes hard to get, you know, if you're in the southern part, there's a very distinctive style, and in the northern part, there's a very different style. And so learning those styles can be, it's always fun, you know, but you don't learn immediately.
Well, in fact, why don't you start with a passage that begins, "When Northerners eat rice."
When Northerners eat rice, they pick it up with the tips of their fingers and then use their thumb to push the small amount of rice into their mouth. In southern regions, people eat rice using the entire hand, forming a ball of rice, approximately the size of a golf ball, by gathering the rice into their palm, flicking the wrist sideways to shape it into a mass, and then finally tossing the entire ball into their mouth. As a foreigner, it's fun to watch and to learn, to try to imitate, though a style doesn't come quickly. After a while, when you think that you've got it down, the style itself feels somehow crucial to the food, as if that particular food has to be eaten in that particular way. And if you eat by hand, when you're finished with your meal, you still have that tasty little bits on your fingers, and then later, even after you've washed your hands, there's a delicious aroma that lingers on your fingers. As foreigners, we find all this wonderfully addictive, and so we can only imagine how important it would feel if we'd been eating this way, the same food, all our lives, and how unsatisfying it would feel to eat with utensils.
Do you have that feeling when you come home, Jeffrey Alford, that it's just not as satisfying?
Oh, in a lot of ways, yeah. But specifically in the eating, it's amazing how you just, like, you're in one place and a language just comes out of your mouth. And then you get on a plane and you go someplace else and the other language comes out of your mouth. It's the same way with eating. Like, we'll often be in India and then we'll fly to Thailand. And in Thailand, they eat with rice with a spoon. And, you know, immediately that's the, you know, we would never think of eating our rice in Thailand with our hand.
Well, you've got a chapter in the book entitled Chutneys, Salsas, and Sambals. First off, what's a sambal?
A sambal is particularly in Sri Lanka. Mm. It's a chili paste, but it can be, you know, sort of wet or dry. It's a very large category, but it's a little bit confusing because there are also sambals in Indonesia. But they're very different from Sri Lankan sambals.
Yeah. And when you say chutneys, you're not talking about boiled fruit.
No, we're not. And in fact, we'd almost like to sort of eliminate that word chutney because it has such a, I don't know, I'm not really a big fan of that bottled, you know, mango, whatever that, mm-hmm. you know, I don't really like that. But chutney as, again, this category of, say, salsas, you know, you need that sort of hot part in the meal, that sort of fresh, hot, oftentimes, you know, with a lot of fresh herbs. Mm. It's such a great category of foods, and chutney somehow isn't seem to be a very good word for it.
What's the most exotic ingredient in the subcontinent?
I don't think of almost anything as exotic there. You know, we worked a long time in Southeast Asia, and I would say there's some truly exotic ingredients in Southeast Asia. But in South Asia, you know, some people say, what did you really have difficulty eating? And I think, I don't really have difficulty eating anything. It's pretty normal food, you know, for us North Americans. The southern part in Sri Lanka and South India, there are a lot of vegetables and things that we don't have here. Like there's something called a winged bean or also a long drumstick. And we wrote these into the book because we think, you know, some, they're here now, but in, you know, in the near future, there will be even more around.
Well, and some of the things are as common as all get out. In fact, you have a recipe for beets that, you know, was a little bit like borscht.
Yeah, a little bit odd, too, because though that recipe comes from, again, South India and Sri Lanka, where it's a very tropical place. You're initially surprised to see beets, which we think of as, you know, a very cold weather vegetable, but very prominent all through South India and Sri Lanka.
And by the way, we'll put the recipe on our website, but it involves curry leaves, rice vinegar, coconut milk.
Yeah.
Looks delicious. Jeffrey, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Starving.
That's Hungry Robin Young talking with Jeffrey Alford, co-author of the book Mangoes and Curry Leaves, Culinary Travels Through the Great Subcontinent. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah.